Blog Talk Radio.
Good Saturday morning, everybody, and welcome to another great episode we have here with Suspense Radio. I'm your host, John Robb, and I am pleased to be able to say that we are back after a couple-week hiatus, but we will be off next week, and we will not be back on until August the 27th. But today's show, we are going to have coming up for you here, author Charlie Williams, followed by Emily Arsenault, and then we're going to have the managing editor of The Strand magazine, Andrew Gooley, coming on to talk about a book that he helped edit called No Rest for the Dead. So I want to thank everybody for joining us. I'm your host, John Robb. This great Saturday morning in our new studios in Thousand Oaks, California. So sit back, relax, enjoy, because an hour and a half of Suspense Radio begins right now. So I want to thank everyone again for joining us here on this great Saturday morning here on Suspense Radio, and we have a fabulous show lined up for you. We're going to get right in here to our first caller. Our first guest is author Charlie Williams. His latest book is One Dead Hen, and it is the latest book in the Mangle series. It came out August the 9th. Charlie, so thankful that you can come on today. How you doing?
Hi, I'm doing fine, thanks. Thank you very much, first of all, for inviting me. John.
Hey, yeah, you know, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to have you. You know, we want to get into One Dead Hen, which is the next book in your Mangle series with, you know, your character. Is it Royston? Did I say that right?
Yeah, that's right. Royston Blake.
Royston Blake. So what kind of progression here have we done with One Dead Hen and Royston coming up that people can read that came out on August the 9th?
Okay. Before this in the series, there were three books before this one. Dead Folk, Booze and Burn, which used to be called Fags and Lager. That was the English title. And King of the Road. So three books went before it, and with each one, he's obviously survived because he's still here in the fourth book. But with each one, he's kind of degenerated a bit more. He's gone down a bit because although the character Royston Blake survives each of these books so far, the first three anyway, I can't confirm in One Dead Hen whether he survives or not. Although he survives, I feel like I'm writing in the noir genre. So something's got to break at the end. Something's, you know, it's got to have a, it's kind of a doubt. It's a downward spiral for Royston Blake. He's a guy who makes bad decisions. He tries his hardest. He reaches for the stars, but things go wrong. So with each of these books, he's gone sort of further downhill in the hierarchy of Mangle, his hometown. And in this one, he doesn't actually have a job at all. But the first two, he was a nightclub bouncer in the sort of the premier night spot in Mangle, third one, he was a security guard, and now he's not much at all. He's a hermit, in fact, at the beginning of the novel.
Now, if we could get a little bit, you know, kind of like put it on the map, where would you say Mangle would be, you know, in the UK? Where would that be set at? So we can kind of understand maybe a little bit about where that is.
Right. Well, it's loosely based on my hometown, where I am now, in fact, was born here, Worcester. The only thing that this place is known for in the world is Worcester sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, whatever you want to call it, the stuff you put in cocktails. There's not much else has come from here, apart from...
Well, besides you...
Yeah, there's me. And,
right.
And although I don't really count myself that highly yet, you know, got stuff to do. But there's another guy.
Don't kid yourself. You're higher. Don't kid yourself. You're higher than a song that goes.
Glory and did he write that? Yeah, I think he wrote that.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's based on that place, right? So Mangle is loosely based on Worcester. In all my books, I've written about Worcester because it seems to be where my inspiration comes from. But I write about the kind of the dark side of it, not dark in a twilight world, but the seamy side, the criminal underbelly, the sinister side of Worcester. And I didn't want people saying, hang on, Worcester is nothing like that. Worcester's a nice place. You've exaggerated all this. I didn't want any of that, so I invented my own name, my own version of my hometown, called it Mangle, which is it's got sinister undertones in itself, and now I can do what I like with it. It's an invented town. I can play with it. But, yeah, you would position it on a map somewhere to the sort of to the west side of England in the middle of nowhere because it's... Mangle is... Well, Worcester used to be kind of isolated because when I was growing up there, I felt claustrophobic, but we didn't get any bands coming to play, you know, music. I felt claustrophobic, so I exaggerated that in Mangle. And Mangle is so in the middle of nowhere that no one actually leaves the place. Everyone's got this idea that they can never leave, and very few people come in, and no one even knows where it is. It's completely isolated, which allows me to write a certain kind of story.
Now, this is the fourth book in the Mangle series, and it's One Dead Hand. I want to remind everybody we're talking here with Charlie Williams. It's charliewilliams.net is your website. People can go and find out all the other things that you've written because you've done other stuff than just the Mangle series. And now, seeing as how this is book four, would you say that somebody, you know, can they go ahead and pick up One Dead Hand and start with the Royston Blake, or would you suggest they go back to Dead Folk and then go through, you know, Booze and Burn and King of the Road before they reach it, or how should they kind of progress themselves in if somebody who's new to your writing?
I'm glad you asked that, John. That's an important question because you can write these series, but if every new reader has to go back to the first one, it's kind of difficult. So what I've done with each of these books in this series is I've approached it as a standalone. So I haven't harked back to stuff that has gone on in previous ones. Well, I might kind of mention it for people who are following the series. But there's nothing you need to know about the previous books in order to enjoy this book or any of the books on its own, without reading the ones that came before. In each one, well, Royston Blake, you know, it's a kind of, he's a character that I wouldn't describe him as thick, I wouldn't describe him as stupid or brain damaged or anything like that, but someone else might describe him like that. What it is he's none too clever. He can't really perceive too much about what's going on between the lines around him. He takes everything at face value. He's deluded. He's got massive self-delusions. So he thinks he's one thing and he's not. The rest of the world sees him as different. So as far as he goes, he doesn't care about what's happened in the previous books. No matter what kind of disasters befell him in King of the Road or Booze and Burn, he's like, you know, when he gets a new scheme in his mind, you know, he's the king of the road. You know, he is the guy. So he doesn't care about all the stuff that happened before. and it's all narrated by him. All the books are narrated by him. So you only hear what he wants to tell you. So when you sit down with one of these books, you know, you're at the bar with him. You're sat next to him at the bar, and he's telling you this story. You don't need to know about all the other stories beforehand. However, you know, when you've read One Dead Hen or King of the Road or whatever, I hope that you might be, you know, you might be interested enough to see what happened before. So you would get an arc of how he develops upwards or downwards if you read the other books. But yes, in short, each book is a standalone.
Now, you're doing some events, you know, to help promote the book, and a lot of it is going to be over in England, except you were over here for the Book Expo in America. Are you coming back over to the States at all for this year to do any more events, or are you going to be staying in England for pretty much the remainder of the year?
Yeah, I'll be over here. You know what, that Book Expo, America, that's the first time I've been to America, so that was fantastic.
Really?
This year. Yeah, I've never been.
And what'd you,
I've always wanted
what'd you
to.
Think?
I've always been obsessed with the idea of going to America, because if you're a kid growing up in Britain during the 70s and 80s, it's all about American stuff. You know, it's all the TV shows, comics, the music. You know, America is the place where it seems where it all comes from, all the popular culture. Well, that's how it seemed to me. So I always wanted to go there, but not until this year did I finally get there. So yeah, that was fantastic. But I've got no other plans to go back to do more events in America. However, I would change that at the drop of a hat if the right opportunity came along, the right, you know, a reason to go there. So all it's going to take is another excuse to get me over there. But yeah, we don't really have book tours like you have in America quite so much, because for the simple reason there aren't as many bookstores in Britain. So what I've done is I've just done a few events here and there for these books, and I'll schedule in any others, and I dot them throughout the year. But yeah, I tell you what I'd like to do next year is go to BoucherCon. Is it called, pronounced BoucherCon?
Yeah, BoucherCon,
yeah.
Yes.
That's it. That's the one I'd like to go to the most. I mean, it sounds fantastic. I've heard about lots of other people from Britain going over there and saying what a great time they have and new books they discover. So I hope to do that next year.
Yeah, we were just at BoucherCon in San Francisco. It's coming up again here in September in St. Louis. Last year it was in San Francisco. Next year, I believe, it's going to be in Cleveland. So I'm sorry about your second trip to the United States. You actually have to go to Cleveland, Ohio. It's not going to be the greatest part of the United States. You know, I'm from Ohio, so I can talk about it that.
It's all America to me. It's all the same thing as far as I'm concerned. It's all got that magical aura of just being America.
Well, you're going to see a different side of America. You go to Cleveland, but the event itself for BoucherCon is very fan friendly. So you're going to meet a lot of different people, fans, and a lot of different authors that you probably have read, you know, because I know that you, you know, you were with a panel with John Conley, you know, he's very well known. So, you know, you're just going to meet a lot of different things. It's a great place to go, so I would highly suggest going to BoucherCon.
Definitely going to do everything I can to get over there then, now you said that.
Yeah. So now, you know, and speaking of journeys and, you know, going to different things and doing a lot of different things, you yourself had a personal journey on, you know, you're now being published through Amazon Encore, which is one of their newest imprints. You know, can you explain a little bit about, you know, how your journey went in order to kind of get to where you're at now?
Yeah, it's a bit of a long haul for me, because Dead Folk, my first book, which is actually the first in this series, was published in 2004 originally by the London publisher Serpent's Tail, who are probably better known for publishing the likes of George Pelikanos and Walter Mosley over here. And so they published that, and they published the next two in the series, Fags and Lager, which is now Booze and Burn, and King of the Road. And then I had a little break. I was, you know, because I put, that was one per year, those were. They were one every year for a while.
Right.
And the next one, a little bit longer, did something else first. The next one, I couldn't get it published by them. They didn't want to publish it. And it was a kind of shock because you think, you know, when you start getting published, you think, that's it. I'm going to get every book I write published now. I'm off.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's not the case. And I discovered it. Also discovered that it was due to sales figures. And not really much I can do about that. I can't get into the bookshops and force them to stock my books. But the previous book, King of the Road, hadn't really sold enough. So Serpent's Tail, my publisher, which had recently been bought by a larger publisher, the new owners looked at the sales figures and told my editor, although he had accepted my new book, said, look, this series is going downwards. There's no point in continuing with this series. It's going downwards in sales. So I did another book with Serpent's Tail, which wasn't part of the series. But in the meantime, you know, I tried to put it behind me and move on. But, you know, this character, Royston Blake, who I've been talking about, who narrates these novels, the hero, he just won't shut up. And, you know, this is where it gets weird for you, probably, what I'm talking about. But he won't shut up in my head. He's a voice which I seem to need to write about. So I couldn't do that unless I'd got this next book in the series published. Otherwise, if I continued to write another book, there'd be a gap because this one dead hen hadn't been published. So I worked as hard as I could on someone's suggestion and with their, you know, lots of people's support. There was this Facebook group which was launched to try and gather support for Royston Blake in the next book. And although it didn't get enough numbers to force Serpent's Tail or Serpent's Tail to change their mind, it didn't do that. But it got me enough press attention over here for Alex Carr, my editor at Amazon Encore, to notice. And he had read Dead Folk, maybe the second one too. And he came in and said, well, let's have a look at this. Can I see this book? And it led from there. So, and, you know, whereas I could have just put this book in the drawer and forgotten about it and got on with something else, it eventually has found the light of day again and been published, along with republished with all the others, through Facebook, really, through gathering support on Facebook. So, yeah, that's quite a journey, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, so you can actually say that, you know, Facebook actually, you know, worked for a good thing instead of, you know, being kind of what it's evolved into and other different things. But, yeah, I mean, see, that's kind of, you know, one of those journeys where I always have to tell young authors, you just have to keep plugging away at it, you know, because everyone asks, well, how do you sell more books or how do you do this? If there was a correct formula for all of that, everybody would be doing it, and no one really knows the correct stuff. So, but with you, it's just persevering along and, you know, believing in your work and keeping it going, and that's what got it going. And you just have to keep believing in yourself that what you're doing is right.
Exactly. And the other thing is that so many authors expect to be an immediate success these days, and publishers expect them to be an immediate success. And maybe a few years ago, you were expected to just trundle along for a while before you actually start making money, but you're not allowed to do that anymore. But it's up to you. You've just got to carry on writing. Even if the publishers say they don't want you, there's commercial reasons that are stopping us publishing your book. You know, you've just got to stick at it because, you know, a successful author is an author who keeps, you know, hacking away at it. And the only people who you can say won't be successful are the ones who give up. So, it's a matter of just staying in the game, isn't it, I think?
Absolutely. I think that's the way to do it. You have to stay in the game. Because once you get out, it's very difficult to get back in.
Totally agreed. And look, I got to come to America this year. And it's all, you know, it's through Amazon publishing. And none of that would have happened. I would have never been to America, probably, if I hadn't. And all the hundreds of supporters who got on this Facebook group and, you know, press people who supported me and, you know, and printed articles. Without that, I wouldn't have got to come to America, and I did.
So now, we're speaking here with author Charlie Williams. His website is charliewilliams.net. We're talking about his latest book in his Mangle series with his character Royston Blake called One Dead Hen. It's the fourth book, but as Charlie said before, he wrote them, so you can read them individually, and you can go on his website and find more information. Go to Amazon and buy all four books at one time. And I want to ask you right now, too, about Royston Blake. If he was sitting in front of you, what is one thing you would like to ask him? One question that you would like to know a little bit more about Royston?
God, that is a weird question. I mean, that's a very good question. But to me, it's weird because I consider Royston Blake in a really messed up way. I consider him to be like my alter ego.
I like that.
He's
a really messed up
one. He's a person who doesn't think, he just does. You know, he has total confidence in himself. He thinks all women love, you know, fancy him. He thinks all men respect him and would never cross him. So he's got this total belief. And, you know, as a normal person, as a kind of well-adjusted person, I'm the opposite of that. I don't go around bigging myself up and I think before I do stuff. So, what's the one question? It's funny because when you have a hero across four books, actually it's going to be five, I hope, because I'm sort of writing another one. But when you have a hero across those books, you like to think that you've asked every question via another character that needs to be asked of that person. But you never have. I think what you're asking there is the thing that I will never find out. I'll always be trying to probe away at this character and find out what makes him tick, or what reasons there are for him being like this. But I can't, you know, if I found it, I'd probably stop writing the series if I found the question to ask him, because that might make him not unravel so much as just resolve his whole situation. It's like the J.G. Ballard thing, you know, the author J.G. Ballard. He wrote all these amazing imaginative novels, and then he wrote The Empire of the Sun, which kind of explained where it had all come from. And once we knew his background and where it had all come from, I don't know about you, but I think his stuff kind of dropped off a bit. So it's like once you explain what this guy is about, that's the end. So I'm not sure if I want to find the ultimate question to ask Royston Blake. I might ask him for tips on chatting up women, though.
And, you know, I think your explanation was perfect, where it's basically, like you said, if you do find those kinds of things, then it almost is time to say, I think he needs to stop doing what he's doing, because you're continually searching and continually evolving, and he just keeps going on, and that's part of the joy in you writing the stories, is seeing how he evolves and how he continues.
Yes.
And what kind of lunacy he keeps doing.
Yeah, that's it. That's totally. I mean, every new book I start to write with him, I know what he's done before. I kind of think I know what he's about, but you know, I discover something else. Not so much a new side to him, but a new area that he needs to go down to try and, I don't know, maybe there's a finite number of books that need to be written about Royston Blake, and once he's gone down each of those paths, maybe he's resolved himself. But I haven't got to the end yet, so I hope to publish another one after this, at least another one.
Well, that was going to be our next question. What is coming up in the future? So you just said you pretty much have no end in sight, which is, you know, always good for your fans. You know, fans like to, you know, kind of like to hear that it's going to continue on and go. So you're writing book five now, or has it been written, or is it you're still in the middle of it?
Well, I don't like to say it's finished, but I've written the first draft. So I've got to that magical point in any writer's year where they write the end, where they get to the end of it. I mean, you strive for that moment when you've got to the end of your first draft. You know, you just say, please, to the God of writing, please let me get to the end, and then I'll work out all these problems that I know are in there. I just want to get to the end. I don't want this to be another abandoned manuscript which I never finished. But as soon as you get there, as soon as you write the end, immediately you look at it and you see all the problems and you see all the work that lays ahead of you. So, yeah, I've written the first draft. But yeah, there's I'm mired in second draft phase at the moment. But yeah, this is going to be another Royston Blake book. I don't know when it will be scheduled because I haven't submitted it. It's going to be another month or so before it gets in the shape to do that. But yeah, I would hope that there's going to be another Royston Blake book next year. Don't know what it's going to be called, though. Can't give away that.
So kind of last question, kind of off topic of books and this and that, because it's very prevalent going on right now in the news, actually, is what the hell is going on in London? And is there a book coming out of that one?
That's a good one as well. The riots. Yeah, I mean, people have been asking me that. I don't know why they're asking me if I'm going to write a book about this. Am I sort of the go-to guy for casual street violence?
Hey, Royston used to be a bouncer. I think he can just step out on the street and just start, you know, doing whatever his thing is. Like you said, he just kind of just goes and does it. So you might be the go-to.
Yeah. He could fix all this, yeah. He would just wade in there, and but you'd end up with a few dead people. yeah, what is going on? I'll tell you the one thing is that it's all stopped now. I mean, touch wood, the nightly violence and the looting and the fires, that's all stopped. That stopped earlier in the week.
Okay.
But it took a change in tactics from the police to do this. And because at first they weren't, but the police seemed to be so terrified of getting done for over aggression and being sued for using force against criminals,
right,
that they weren't really doing very much. They were kind of hamstrung. But as these riots have spread to all the cities around England, like Liverpool, and you know, more aggressive tactics have been used, and the public has got behind that, because you've got to stop this, you know, you've got to do whatever it takes to stop it. That the police seem to have, either the police have got a hold on it around the country, or the rioters have just got all the flat screen TVs and watches they wanted, and they're stopping now.
and there's nothing left.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, Charlie, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It has been an absolute pleasure. And we look forward to book 5 coming out here in the series. Your latest book, One Dead Hen, wish you nothing but success. Thank you so much for joining us.
John, thank you so much for having me on. And, you know, all the best to Suspense Radio.
Thank you so much. And enjoy yourself. And we look forward to book 5. So we'll have you back on during that time. And maybe we'll see you at VoucherCon in Cleveland next year.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. I'll get on that one. See you.
There you go.
Thanks very much.
All right. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that was author Charlie Williams, and that was his latest book that we talked about, One Dead Hen, the fourth book in the Mangle Royston Blake series. You can find out more information on charliewilliams.net. Very interesting character, Royston Blake, one that you probably have not read before, so I think that if you're definitely a fan of suspense mystery thriller, that this is one that you have to go pick up, crime fiction, because Royston Blake is definitely a different breed of character that has not quite been written yet. So I think that all fans would like it. So again, that's charliewilliams.net, and the book is One Dead Hen, and it is available now. So what we're going to do is, you know, we're waiting for our next guest, and her name is Emily Arsenault. Hopefully I did not butcher that name, and I'm sure she'll tell me when I get on. But we're going to talk about her latest book here, which is called In Search of the Rose Notes, and it's a female-focused mystery, but is definitely a mystery, and it is her second book from Emily. Her first one was called The Broken Tea Glass. And her website is emilyarsenault.com. That's ArsenAult.com to find out more information on her. So I want to go ahead and bring Emily on, and I want to say thank you, Emily, so much for joining us, and good morning, and how are you doing?
Hi, good. Thanks for having me.
So did I say your name right? Is it Arsenault?
Yeah, that's how I pronounce it, Arsenault. Americanized.
Okay, good. I am terrible at last names, and I like to butcher them, so that's why I wanted to make sure that I said it correctly. So your latest book, In Search of the Rose Notes, is out right after your last one, which was The Broken Tea Glass. This is kind of your sophomore hit after your debut. So can you kind of tell everybody a little bit about In Search of the Rose Notes and kind of how you put it together and what's going on inside of it?
Sure. It's on one level it's a mystery, but it's also kind of a story about adolescence and memory. And it's got two alternating narratives that go back and forth between 1990 and 2006. And when you first meet the main characters, they're 11 years old. There are two girls named Nora and Charlotte. And they're both actually into the paranormal together. You know, that's pretty much the basis of their friendship, that they're both interested in this topic. They have the Time Life series on that topic that was very popular in the late 80s and early 90s about, you know, alien abductions and psychic powers and things like that. And they spend their days kind of poring over these books. And they have this babysitter. Well, one of them has this babysitter named Rose, who's 16, who kind of spends some of her time with them, kind of humoring them while they do this. And she unfortunately disappears. She walks the narrator, Nora, home one night and presumably keeps walking up to her house, but in fact she's never seen again. So now the girls have kind of a purpose for their paranormal studies, which is trying to figure out what happened to Rose. And the search, you know, their little investigation really doesn't go anywhere. And in fact, it leads to the end of their friendship because it's particularly uncomfortable for Nora, who is the last person to see Rose that anyone knows of. And then in 2006, Rose's bones are found. And this draws Nora, the narrator, back into her old hometown that she's long since left and back into this old friendship and back into the case of what happened to this teenage girl all those years ago. So that's the basic premise of the book.
Now, what I find, you know, kind of extremely interesting about it is that it is, you know, you had two 11-year-olds, Nora and Charlotte, and their babysitter goes missing, but then all of a sudden you're bringing it back, so you're kind of having the beginning story and then you're all of a sudden bringing it back in the book to sit there, and then, you know, you're kind of rehashing the old emotions and the old feelings from when you're 11, and you kind of have to do the grow-up writing thing, because when you're 11, the emotions are a little bit different than when you're in your late 20s, so, you know, you're talking 15, 16, 17 years later. How difficult was that to kind of change writing from writing like 11-year-olds to now writing people in their late 20s and that emotional difference in them growing?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. In fact, I found the 11-year-old parts easier to write. And I don't really know what that means, but it was fun to be 11-year-olds and just to revisit that space. People ask me, was that hard? And I often say, no, you know, it wasn't really. I feel like I remember being 11 pretty well. But, you know, it was interesting to, you know, try to take the same characters and particularly the same narrator. Now they're 27 and
right.
Try to think about how have they changed, but then how have they not changed? How do you keep their some fundamental things about their personalities so the reader can see, oh, you know, that is the same person in a way. You know, of course, they come at the mystery in a totally different way. In the 2006 parts, you know, they're not really discussing the paranormal very much. That pretty much kind of fades into the background. And they're thinking about it now with a kind of a perspective on adolescence, too. One of them is a high school teacher now. She's maybe not a very good high school teacher, you know, they've both been teenagers and moved beyond that. So they have kind of a different perspective on Rose. They used to look up to her, and now she seems much younger than them. So they can think about it in that way. What kind of choices did she make? You know, maybe, you know, she wasn't as sophisticated as we thought, or didn't make the kind of choices we would have thought she would have made when we were 11. So.
Now, was this kind of a book that you wrote, like, from the end back to the beginning, where you kind of had this idea, hey, what if a babysitter was abducted and this and that and this, and then you kind of wrote it backwards, forwards, or how did you kind of construct this story?
Well, I started with, I knew I wanted to write about teenagers, and in fact, for when I first started writing the book, Nora and Charlotte were 16 themselves, and it was a book kind of about their story of being teenagers, and I found it actually in a way too dark. So then I decided, okay, 11-year-olds who have this perspective on this teenager, and that's when I added the stuff about the paranormal and the Time Life books to put a little lightness in the book, because I found it was just getting a little too dark, and I wanted there to be at least some humor. So that's kind of how it evolved. And I wrote a couple of drafts. In a very early draft, the ending was somewhat different, and I found it kind of unsatisfying and had to go back and rethink it and rewrite it. And that's usually what I do. I think I know what the ending is, and then when I get close to it, I realize that I'm not satisfied and I have to go back and change some things. So, and that can be pretty frustrating.
And now growing up, or now today, are you still very much a big, you know, paranormal fan?
Not so much. I really was growing up a lot. I mean, that was primarily what I read, things about ghosts and psychics. I just loved that. I ate it up. And I still like an occasional movie about things like that. I love a creepy movie. But I don't read a real lot of paranormal type stuff, actually, now as an adult. I probably should, but I read more, you know, mysteries, realistic mysteries and things like that. But
so when you basically sit there and you talk about when you decided to kind of write The Broken Tea Glass, was that something that had been brewing for quite some time, or, you know, that story was brewing for quite some time?
The Broken Tea Glass?
Yeah, your first book, The Broken Tea
yeah.
Glass.
No, not so much. The story of that book is I was actually in the U.S. Peace Corps with my husband, and we were in rural South Africa, and we had a real lot of free time. Just because it's you're in a rural place and there's no television, and so even
kind
though
like
I was
Ohio,
going,
yeah.
And yeah, so we both I had written a book before that never got published, so it wasn't like it was just this lark, but we both decided, oh, well, while we have this free time in the evenings, we'll both try to write novels. We'll try to get, you know, we each try to get a novel done, and he was working on a sci-fi book, and I just decided, I'll try a mystery. And I had worked at Merriam-Webster, the dictionary company, so it just felt like that would be a fun place to try a mystery. It's very unusual. So I just kind of went from there, and I tried lots of different ideas and before I came to the one that I just how the mystery would happen at this mystery at this dictionary company. But I wouldn't say I'd been thinking about it for that long. You know, I had this thought that a dictionary company would be a unique setting for a novel. It wasn't until I had that experience where I was sitting down and having the time to be disciplined that I really tried it. So
I want to remind everybody, we're speaking here with Emily Arsenault, and her latest book is In Search of the Rose Notes. You can find her at emilyarsenault.com. That's ArsenAult. Now, and I was going to mention, that was the next thing I was going to mention, which is funny because I've never met anybody who actually worked at a dictionary place, and you got to write definitions for the dictionary. Now, how does one, first of all, get a job like that? And how much fun could it be to just, you see some words you've never written before and say, yeah, that looks like a paper clip in the grass, or some weird definition or whatever you can make up. I mean, how does that come about?
Well, I got the job, actually I had studied philosophy in college, and I graduated, this is actually true of my character as well in that book, just not knowing what I was going to do with that. And near the college that I had graduated from was Merriam-Webster, and they put out an ad somewhere, like I think they sent it to all the colleges, that they were looking for liberal arts grads to train. So I just applied for it, and I just ended up there. It was never something I had planned to do, and I don't think I had even thought about that people actually write the dictionary definitions. So that's how I came to that job. And they like to have people from all different areas of study, not just English, because it, that helps, you know, with defining. You know, they need people who know about different things. So I guess I actually was a philosophy and religion major. But so, and then defining, you know, I had no idea how they did it until they trained me, but they do it based on evidence. Dictionary editor.
You just can't fake it? You just can't fake it? I thought you're
no,
really good
no,
at Scrabble.
You can't fake it. That would be a lot easier, actually. We would spend about an hour a day reading, like just books, magazines. I'm sure they do a lot more blogs and things like that now. And you mark up whenever you saw anything that looked like a new word or a new use of an old word or just something interesting or notable, you'd underline it. And all of this, you know, and then you'd mark off a few sentences of context. And then all of this evidence would be turned into citations, which were these little slips of paper, you know, that, you know, and then when you're defining a word, you would have a stack of these little slips of paper that you'd go through and kind of decide, is this being used frequently enough in enough variety of sources? Has it just been around a year or so, in which case you would reject it? Or, you know, has it been being used, you know, for a good 10 years or so? Does it need a definition now? And I wouldn't make, like, I was only an assistant editor, so, you know, I might draft a definition, but a senior editor who would do the final edits, you know, might make cuts, not to, you know, they'd look over your work and they'd be the ones to really make the final decisions. You know, I could write a definition, but that wouldn't necessarily mean it would make the cut into the dictionary. So
writing a book, when you're sending it into your editor and they're cutting things out, this and that, you're used to all of that.
Yeah, I think I usually appreciate it when they, because I can, yeah. I can go on and on. So I usually am pretty trusting of them when they tell me, you know, this can go.
Now, seeing as how In Search of the Rose Notes is your second book and The Broken Tea Glass was your debut, what's one of the one thing, I guess, since you're fairly new, is what myth was kind of busted for you once you got your publishing contract and your editor and everything else like that, that you thought was going to be different, but it was totally different from what you thought it was going to be?
It's hard because there are a lot of things that are different from what you think they're going to be. I mean, one thing that I didn't realize was the timing of things. You know, that things do take time in publishing, longer than you think they're going to, and there's a reason for that. You know, a cover
right.
has to be made and revisions have to be done, and you certainly aren't your editor's only author, you know, so they can't read them, you know, the week you send them in. And so the timing, I think, was a big adjustment for me.
So there's a lot of time when you kind of like hurry up and wait, like, hey, get this to me before July 1st, and you get in the revisions, and then all of a sudden August 15th rolls around, and then you finally get your changes, and you've been sitting there for, you know, 45 days thinking of maybe something new or having to do something different with your time. I mean, that kind of can happen that way too.
Yeah, that was a big adjustment, and I feel like the second time around it was a lot easier because I knew it was coming. The first time around, there's a lot of paranoia. Why haven't I heard? They've decided they don't like the book. It's not going to be published. Because you just wait these long periods of time and start wondering what happened. And then the second time around, I knew nothing happened. This is just how it goes. So
I was going to say, how many times did that thought go through your head? Oh, my God, they haven't called me in 2 weeks. There's just something wrong with the book. Oh, what's going on? So,
yeah.
So those things kind of creep into your head real fast.
Yeah, all the time, the first time around. Yeah. And actually, I have kind of a long, by the time, from when it was purchased, you know, by a publisher to when it was published, was 2 years, which is, I guess, a little on the long side. So.
No, you're kind of in the middle. You're kind of right in the average range, actually. I mean, I've seen people up to 8 years they wrote, and all of a sudden they finally got published. And I've seen others that happened in, you know, 6 months. So 2 years is actually a very nice average time of how long it takes for someone to, you know, once you got it out there, for the agents and for it to get going.
Yeah, well, that was from when an editor actually bought it to when it was published. But yeah, I've heard that it can be a lot longer, even just for that
page.
Yeah. So.
So now, coming up in the future, seeing as how both of your books, The Broken Tea Glass, which is your first one, and now your newest one, In Search of the Rose Notes, you're kind of, you know, writing the, you know, those mystery, very, very much you put in a lot of suspense with the mystery. And what I mean by that is I know that a lot of people say, well, what's the difference? You know, we want to find out what happened. Well, there's a bigger difference when you think of mystery because people think of the whodunit and this and that. But your suspense and mystery is, you know, when you're going with Nora and Charlotte together in this journey of figuring out what happened to Rose and their journey, that's more of the suspense part with the mystery of, you know, what happened. So you've kind of done it a little bit on the unique side, which is very good to see. And is that what you're going to continue on in the future? Have you decided to maybe, you know, stick with or write about a series of characters or, you know, do a series? Or are you going to just continue to more standalones? What is your thoughts for the future in your writing career?
I think I'll continue. The next one I'm working on is a standalone. It's completely different from the first two. And I'm glad that I have the freedom to do that so far. I have a sort of serious character in the back of my head who I'd like to try. But that's pretty far in the future. Because my next book, at least, is completely standalone. And I don't read a lot of series either, so I think I don't think that way. I think I often think in terms of just one book, and that the story is over after that. So I think I'd have to read some more series before I could think really seriously about how that's done well.
Now, I see that on your website here, emilyarsenault.com, that, you know, you have some events that you're doing, like August 25th, you have a book signing coming up, and then in October you're doing some things. Typically what I always like to know is with, you know, an author that, you know, you weren't in marketing or public speaking or anything like that, how difficult was it for you now to have to sell yourself out there in the world to a bunch of millions of unknown people to get your book sold?
Yeah, it's something I'm getting used to. In some ways, I don't really know what works yet.
We don't either.
No.
I have no idea.
So, I mean, you just try different things, and, you know, I do events, mostly people I know come to those, and, you know, and those are enjoyable. I don't know how much that sells books to people you don't, you know, I don't know, I don't get great turnout for that, but, you know, and I've started going on Facebook. I have a Facebook fan page and experimenting with that. It takes getting used to because it's so different from the actual writing, and, I'm not really a very public person.
And does your publicist kind of help you along when she kind of sees that you're very new at doing these things, and you kind of, you know, does she give you a lot of helpful hints and tips? And, you know, I know that she's the one who contacted us about you, so she's kind of done on that end. But has, you know, do they kind of help you out a lot with that?
Yeah, that certainly helps. You know, because she's done this before, she has lots of ideas about who might be interested, and. You know, usually the publicist at the publisher has limited time for each book, and you do a little on your own. Like, I've gotten most of my local press and been pretty successful at that, and you get a little from the publisher. But my publisher has certainly been very helpful. But you've got to balance it between doing some of your own as well as relying on their knowledge as well.
So, when we talked about going forward, you're going to write, you know, more. You're going to continue with standalones. You're not really into the series thing. But have you thought? Is there still a story in your head, or maybe a character in your head that you've been trying to get out that you've just kind of maybe had that writer's block on that you're continually working on, and something, you know, that eventually we're going to see, or are you just kind of go with it one book at a time and you really don't think or have anything that, you know, that far ahead?
I do have one thing like that, and that's, I mentioned I was in rural South Africa a few years ago with my husband, and I, between each book, I always say, okay, this is when I'm going to write about South Africa. I'm going to have some kind of suspense happening in a rural setting in South Africa, and I've never really been able to pull it off. I always decide on something else instead, so I have all the notes on this thing, and you know, it changes each time I look at it. I think maybe the challenge is making it interesting and suspenseful to someone who's never been in that country, and I want to do it right, so I keep stopping and working on something a little more familiar, and I hope that someday that book is actually written.
And now, you know, and speaking of the Peace Corps, because that's a very interesting thing, I mean, how long were you and your husband in the Peace Corps, and how did you guys end up in South Africa? Did they just kind of tell you where to go, or do you have the idea to pick, you know, possibly where you want to go?
They let you suggest where you would like to go. Often you can just suggest what continent you prefer, and we did say we preferred Africa.
So you got five of them to choose from. You're not going to Antarctica.
Right. So they often will honor such a broad request as that. And, you know, we ended up in South Africa. And it was 2 years. That's a pretty standard Peace Corps tour. Sometimes people stay three if they really like it and their job is going well and they have things they want to continue. But that's how we ended up. And that was all my idea. I had always wanted to go to Africa with the Peace Corps since I was pretty young. And I kept talking about it. And even before we were married, and you can't join together till you're married. And then finally, we were almost 30. And we thought, well, if we don't do it now, we're never going to do it. So we just went ahead.
It was an easy process for the Peace Corps. I mean, is it something that's easy, or does it take a long time of once you initially contact them and start going through the process?
It takes a long time. It's actually more competitive now to get a spot than when we went because of the economy. There are a lot of, you know, kids graduating college or people between situations who will decide to try it out. So they have a lot more applicants than they ever did, is my impression. But, you know, if you stick with the application process, which is very long, often over a year, and a lot of people drop out of that process, but if you stick with it, you know, it's tedious and bureaucratic, but eventually most people who really want it, who have the basic qualifications, do get a position.
Now, seeing as how you're pretty much a mystery writer and you're writing, you know, mysteries, what one mystery that's out there that you would like to solve for yourself and know the answer to? Any mystery.
Like a real-life mystery?
Yeah, like I would love to know who the hell Jack the Ripper was. I would love to figure that out. Who was this guy?
Well, this is going to sound really odd, but when I was...
We love odd. We love it.
When I was a kid, I don't know how I found this topic. I was probably about Nora and Charlotte's age. I did a report on this judge named Judge Crater who disappeared. I think it was around 1910. And there were all these news stories about it. It was in New York State somewhere. And no one knows whatever happened to him. They think maybe the mob killed him or something. But as I was doing this report as a kid, I had this dream that while doing the report, I would solve this mystery of the disappeared Judge Crater. And anyway, it was just kind of a... What's that?
Have you ever went back? Because now the internet is out, to see if there's any more information on it or something to research and maybe write a book around the disappearance and using your own, you know, imagination on whatever you want to say happened to him?
I should. And now that I talk about it, I've forgotten that when I was in South Africa, both my brother and my mother separately sent me articles that something came out around the time I was out of the country that someone thought that they had new information about this case that nobody cared about anymore except me. But they had remembered that I was obsessed with it. So
yeah,
I need to look it up again.
Yeah, and look at the D.B. Cooper stuff that's all coming out right now. So no mystery is definitely too old to go back to. And, you know, let's bring Judge Crater alive.
That's an idea. Judge Crater.
You know, you don't have to use Judge Crater as the actual name, but, you know, his story about what happened. That's kind of how a lot of authors and a lot of them listen to the show. That's kind of how you get your ideas. They just kind of happen, whether you were a kid or, you know, you just stumble along something and then it just catches your interest and you want to find out more about what the heck's going on out there. So you do it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Emily, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It was such a pleasure to have you on. And everybody, the book is In the Search of the Rose Notes. Is there something that you want to add, you know, maybe where you're going to be or anything else that you want, you know, that you might be promoting as far as, you know, charities or anything else like that?
Nothing comes to mind. I should mention that my first book actually is coming out in paperback on September 13th. It came out a while ago, but it's finally coming out in
right.
paperback.
So they're re-releasing it. And you're on all the e-books, too.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, which is also good. So anyone that's got e-books, which is now the number one format to read books, e-books, you can download it right now as you're listening. So, Emily, thank you so much for joining us. It was such a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You have a good day, and we will talk with you soon.
Thanks. You too. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. So again, everybody, that was Emily Arsenault, and she is the author of In Search of the Rose Notes. Her website is emilyarsenault.com, A-R-S-E-N-A-U-L-T, to go check out more information. Extremely interesting book. Like I said, a little bit of different spin on the mystery suspense part. We are going to take just a short break here real fast while I get our next guest on the line, Andrew Gooley. And he is also going to be joined by one of the authors in the book, Matthew Pearl. So we will be back here in just a second. And in the meantime, I got something really cool for you to listen to. Here you go.
Thrill in my head and a pill on my tongue. again.
Everybody, and welcome back, and I want to thank you so much for hanging around here. We have everything all set for our next guest. Like I said, our first guest, but our guest together here is managing editor of The Strand, who's actually in Chicago, and you're going to hear some nice background music going on with Andrew, the managing editor of The Strand, Andrew Gooley, and one of the authors in the book that Andrew helped deliver, No Rest for the Dead, Matthew Pearl. So, guys, thank you so much for joining me. How are you guys doing today?
Fine. How are you doing? Thanks for having us, Don.
Yeah, thank
Good.
You.
Good. So, Andrew, let's start with you first here, and you guys can kind of jump back in and out. The book, No Rest for the Dead, you know, kind of what spawned you on to do this? I mean, you've got 26 huge authors that are in this book, you know, that are kind of writing this series. How did you pull this thing together?
Well, it was not easy, John. It was one of the toughest things I've ever done. To me, when I first start on something, I think that it's going to become just a piece of cake, and then it sort of spirals out of control. And this thing was no exception. I started off first with talking to a lot of my writer friends, and the first two people who said yes were John Lesqua and Seth Garrison. And from there, it spiral to include 25 other writers. So it was not easy, but at the end of the day, I'm very proud of the book, and I'm very happy that the writers just did an incredible job putting it all together.
Well, it's good you didn't have to go to Thailand to find any of the writers, that they were all right here, nice and close.
Exactly.
You know,
I went to Scotland, though.
Okay, well, that's all right. You know, you went over there.
Alexander McCall Smith.
And so, Matthew, how did kind of, you know, your involvement, you know, come about in the book here, No Rest for the Dead?
Well, I was lucky that Andrew thought of me and reached out to me. And this type of project was something unlike anything I've ever done. So I agreed with a little hesitation because I had never done it, and it sounded like it would be a challenge, and it certainly was. But I'm really glad to be a small part of it because it was a very special project.
So either one of you kind of answer this one. It's kind of, you know, what exactly does the book do? Because it's not 26 short stories. You listed as 26 writers, and it's one mystery. Did somebody just start it, and then the other person just sent it on to the next writer, and they just continued it, and they just kept going forward?
Well, it started off in a rather strange way that my friend John Lesqua agreed to write the first chapter, and there was a strict timeline where John would write chapter one, and then I'd have T. Jefferson Parker write chapter two, and so on. So I remember in the summer of 2007, I contacted John. I was in New York City, and I said, okay, John, it's your turn to write the first chapter. And John looks at me and he said, well, he says, Andrew, I'm writing the first chapter, but you're going to have to give me something to go on. I'm like, oh, darn, it's not going to be that easy. So I
had to... You got to give him an idea, I guess.
Yeah, you have to give John an idea. And
right.
I've had this idea for about 6 years about this lady who may have been wrongly executed for murdering her husband, throwing his body in an Iron Maiden with the full knowledge that the maiden was going to be repatriated to a museum in Berlin. And I wrote a prologue about this cop who was instrumental in convicting this lady, his testimony and his investigation. And 10 years after her execution, he's having second thoughts. He's has a lot of doubt about the case. And he's interested in finding out the real person who had committed that murder. So I wrote the prologue, handed it off to John, and John just took all the characters that I'd created, ran away with them in just the most remarkable way you can imagine. I mean, to me, it was a big thrill that I'd, you know, I don't consider myself a professional writer. I write this prologue, and then you have John LeSquat, the great John LeSquat, taking my characters, running away with them, and just doing a fantastic job.
And now, Matthew, what chapter did you get? And so, and basically, when you get the story, you had, did you have to go back and read all the previous ones to kind of see where the story was going and then put yourself into it?
Unless you're running too through.
Yeah, I got chapter 11, which is more or less in the middle, and I don't think every chapter before me had yet been written, although maybe Andrew remembers, but many of them had. So Andrew sent over whatever had been turned into him. And then there were some chapters that had been written afterwards. So I had those to work with, and I had some summaries that Andrew was able to give me. There were definitely missing pieces that we had to gradually line up for my chapter. I'm sure that's how it worked for all the chapters. And it took a little while for me to get enough of a sense of the book to get started on my draft. And as I say, it was a really big challenge. Even though I only wrote one chapter and can't take much credit for this great book, it was really a great feeling to be able to be part of that kind of collaboration. And this kind of collaborative novel has a long tradition dating back into the 19th century, so it's really fun to get together this number of people and to be able to not collaborate in the same room, but sort of exchange ideas on the page.
Right, and Matthew, how difficult was that for you? Because I don't know if you've read all the other authors on here, I mean, but we're talking, you know, Jeffrey Deaver and Tess Garrison and J.A. Jantz, Faye Kellerman, and on and on and on. You know, did you kind of feel a little, I guess you want to say, was a little overwhelmed? Did you kind of know their writing styles or things like that? Or did you not even worry about any of that, and you just said, I'm writing the way I'm writing, and that's just the way it's going to be?
Well, I did think about that, because I'm traditionally a historical novelist. At least the three novels I've published and one coming out next year are all 19th century historical novels. So I think maybe for me, maybe even more for any of the other authors, this was a challenge in the sense that you're talking about of style, because I had to sort of switch to a modern-day voice and sort of a hard-boiled detective character and texture. So I did study the styles of that the other writers were doing, and I think everyone was trying to more or less not restrict their voice or their style, but make sure that this was a cohesive story rather than a showcase for each different writer's talents. And obviously, there are so many talents there. So in a way, it makes it more difficult, more of a challenge, because you're coping with that. In a way, it takes some of the work away from you, because you don't have to think of everything yourself. You can pick up what some of the strands that other people, and starting with Andrew and all the other writers who started writing chapters, had come up with, and you can build on that.
Now, Andrew, is there somebody that you tried to get into the book that you couldn't? Is there an author missing that just couldn't do it, have enough time, or this and that, or you just couldn't get them involved with it?
Well, I'd like to jump in for just 1 second and just give a tribute to the great job of Matthew, because Matthew, a lot of writers are very close to me. They did very, very good job. But you can understand the nature of this piece, whereby sometimes you'll get a chapter and you'll find that you're on a different wavelength with the author, and you'll just say, okay, I need you to tweak it here, tweak it there. Matthew sort of had like ESP in that he just took this skeleton of a detective, and he was able to just completely form his character and completely get the idea of what I was after in creating this tormented guy who's trying his hand at redeeming himself, feeling very guilty, trying to pick up the pieces of his life. And Matthew just wrote a fantastic chapter. In terms of getting some writers, I'll just have to say that a few people did, you know, I was let down by a few people. A few people committed and then ended up just having, you know, some rather curious excuses why they couldn't write their chapters. A couple of writers disappeared, and one ended up needing emergency hand surgery.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, so, and one was kidnapped
in Thailand, and we don't know where they are yet, right?
I hope a couple of them were the ones who said no, no. In fact, one of my friends, Jonathan Santlofer, sent me an email after he heard about the hand surgery, and he said, I'm going to have an operation on my feet, and this is why I can't complete my chapter. He was, of course, kidding.
So, I mean, but when you're getting into a journey like this, you know, like you said, you kind of have something, and you said Matthew was kind of like ESP'd or maybe dialed into your brain. Was there, when it was going off, and, you know, you kind of put the idea out there and, you know, you always have a sense of maybe how you want it to go. Did it kind of end up going the way you thought, or did it actually go in a totally different direction?
Well, it went in the exact way that I wanted it. And another writer who, like Matthew, sort of picked up upon the idea that I had had for the book and was R.L. Stein. And Bob wrote a chapter that completely turned the book on its head. And I had this plan for this ending, and he did a great, great job in making sure that that would happen. And the thing was this. There was not a strict outline, but the writers were given a knowledge of what would happen, what would be the final upshot of the whole plot. And they helped guide it along. A lot of serial novels can get into the rhythm where each writer is trying to mess up with the other writer, like trying to create an impossible situation. And, you know, you can't have every single writer in the book write a pivotal chapter, because if you do, you'll end up having in a 25-chapter book about 25 dead bodies and 20 chases and maybe 10
arrests.
Because
they all want to kill something. Yeah, because they all want to kill something.
Exactly. They all want to have somebody killed. And this was a great team effort in that the writers were just not interested in showcasing themselves, but in pushing the plot along and making it a very, very strong book.
I have plenty of water on my body.
So Matthew, so you get the call from Andrew. How does he kind of approach you with it? Because I know the book is also, you also did this because of a cause, correct, Andrew? There was, you know, you're not just doing this for, you know, to have 26 things, but isn't there some kind of cause or charity that this is also written for?
Exactly. My mom had passed away from lymphoma in 1997. So 2007, my sister's also an editor, they decided to work on this project and donate all the money to the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society.
And so, Matthew, when you got the call from Andrew, you know, kind of, you know, how does a call like that go? I guess, you know, how does he kind of approach it to you in that way?
Well, I think we started with an email, and Andrew had already gathered some of the names who were going to write chapters, and he told me a little bit about the book and some of those names, and I was sold right away. I've certainly read a lot of the authors. I've met a few of them, so it's great company to be in. And as I say, it's not an easy project to be a part of, even a small part of, because as a writer, you're used to having full authority over what you're imagining and the story you're telling, at least as a novelist. You know, I think writers in other mediums like TV or film are probably accustomed to having people write around them and rewrite things and get things into conformity with other people. So it's, I think, a good experience because it reminds you actually how helpful it is to have a chance for that kind of collaboration, which you don't usually have as a novelist. So I jumped right in, and I hope Andrew does a sequel because it would be fun to do another one.
Well, and so, Andrew, so quick question. You said all the proceeds of the book go to the organization, the Leukemia Lymphoma Foundation. So the authors here, they don't get any royalties for any of these books or anything. They pretty much donated their time for this cause and for your effort.
There was a small honorarium involved that we paid each writer, but the book has been such a hit so far, especially in translation. black even before a copy was printed because it's been translated.
Oh, Andrew. Andrew, you're breaking up a little bit. The Chicago cell phone connection is breaking up a little bit.
I hear. Do you hear me now?
I got you. There you go. Okay, so go ahead. So you're saying the book already hit the block pretty much before it even went out. So, you know, that's got to feel good that all of a sudden you started making money right when it, you know, right when it started hitting.
Exactly, because it's a very, very, it's a good cause. I think it's resonated with a lot of people. I mean, I've had emails from as far away as India and the Far East from people asking about the book, asking when it's going to be available in their language. It's been translated in Arabic, Russian, Turkish, Italian, Dutch. So I'm very, very happy that the world response has been very, very enthusiastic.
So, you know, guys, I just know that it's a monumental task, and I don't think a lot of people understand. It's very difficult to just get one author to come maybe, like, interviews for your magazine, which Andrew is the managing editor for The Strand, or to like come on, you know, the radio show with our radio show or In Suspense magazine. I mean, the monumentalness of the task, I don't think people really can comprehend. And, you know, how many years was it from beginning to end till finally to the end?
It took four long years, and I'm afraid I don't think there will ever be a sequel to this. It just was a very, very stressful project, something I'm not eager to jump into again. It was wonderful to work with the writers. It was great. But when you work in the magazine, you find that, you know, as you know, John, magazine work is a very, very, something you have to be very committed to, long hours. And then this at times would take my weekends over and my evenings over to the point where a lot of my friends are rather upset with me. I mean, why are you canceling your plans? I mean, what's the matter with you? I used to see you all the time. So I'm happy that we did it for a good cause, but I frankly don't think I'll ever try this again. It's sort of like the 1960s comedy, It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World, directed by Stanley Kramer, where he tries to make the comedy to end all comedies by bringing everybody from the Three Stooges to Jack Benny to Milton Berle in the film. And I sort of had this thing where my ego took over and I said, I'm going to create the mystery to end all mysteries. So I was talking to Don LaSquad the other day and he said, Andrew, just tell everybody that you don't have to paint the Mona Lisa twice.
Yes, exactly. I mean, like you said, working on the magazine, definitely you have to be committed, but I also think you have to be committed if you want to be a writer or work in magazine. I think that they should commit you just on that fact. So, but, you know, Matthew, I want you to go ahead and, you know, promote some of your works besides here, No Rest for the Dead. Well, we're speaking here with Matthew Pearl, author in the book No Rest for the Dead, that was conceptualized here by the managing editor of The Strand, who's also on the line, Andrew Gooley. And you can find, you know, Andrew's a competitor of ours. You know, we could care less. Strandmag.com is Andrew's website for his magazine. Matthew, you know, what is your website and your books that you're doing, you know, that you have going on?
Sure. Well, thank you for letting me self-promote. My website is just my name, which is MatthewPearl.com. And I actually have a short story in the current issue of The Strand, so I hope you pick that up. And my first three novels were all literary historical thrillers, using literary history. My first one was called The Dante Club, and that was followed by The Poe Shadow, which is about the death of Edgar Allan Poe, and The Last Dickens, which is about Dickens' unfinished final novel. And I have a new one coming out in February, which is a little different. It's called The Technologists, and it's about the first class at MIT that have to investigate a series of technological disasters in 1868. So it's rather than literary history, it's about technological history, and I think readers will have fun with it.
Well, fabulous. Hey, guys, I want to thank you so much for coming on and talk about the great thing that you did here, Andrew, and No Rest for the Dead, and you know, the cause for leukemia, lymphoma. All the proceeds are going to that. I tell everyone to go get the book. It's an e-book. It's in hardcover. It's available everywhere. Matthew, chapter 11. Everyone, make sure that, you know, chapter 11, that's Matthew's chapter. So, guys, thank you so much for joining us. You know, and Andrew, if you ever want to do something like that, you know, you can always give me a call, and you know, we can, you know, maybe we can hook something up together.
Sounds like a plan, John. Good talking to you, and I'm in the Navy Pier, and I'll be, of course, taking one of the tall ships to explore Thailand.
Nice. That's what we're going to do.
I hope you'll be joining me there.
We will. You just let me know when. You let me know when and where, and I'll be there.
Excellent. Sounds like a plan,
John. All right. Thank you, Andrew, and thank
you,
Matthew.
Thanks for having us.
Take care.
All right. Take care, guys. Enjoy yourself.
Bye.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, that was Andrew Gooley, managing editor of The Strand magazine, and the book was No Rest for the Dead, and also on the line was author Matthew Pearl. You can find Matthew at MatthewPearl.com. He actually wrote Chapter 11. This is 26 mystery writers that wrote this book, No Rest for the Dead, for, like Andrew said, the proceeds go for Leukemia and Lymphoma Foundation. The introduction was written by David Balducci, and just to give you an idea of some of the authors that Andrew was able to put together in this book, you know, he has in here, like I said, David Balducci, introduction, but you have Sandra Brown, you have Jeff Reber, you have Tess Gerritsen, you have Peter James, J.A. Jantz, Faye Kellerman, Gail Lenz, Olin, you know, John Lescroft, Michael Palmer, Kathy Reichs, R.L. Stein, Lisa Scottoline. Those are just some of the names that have contributed their time and effort, you know, into this book. And like he said, 4 years' worth of work went into it, and that's an extremely, extremely daunting task. And, you know, we just, you know, think so much that he was able to put that together. You know, I want to thank everybody for being on the show here today because, you know, we had such a fabulous time. We start off with Charlie Williams and his book that came out, you know, Drop Dead Hen, his fourth book in his Mangle series for Royston Blake. And then Emily Alsenart was on In Search of the Rose Notes and talking about her book. You can find her at emilyalsenart.com. And then, like I said, we just had Andrew on here and Matthew talking about that latest book, No Rest for the Dead. If you're looking for other great books, you know, we have friends of ours, you know, Brad Thor, his book, Full Black, is out. That's one you definitely want to check into. You know, we interviewed Brad. We had Catherine Coulter on the radio. Her book, Split Second, is flying off the charts. That's one that you definitely have to go out and get. There's something new here by Lee Child called Second Son. It's called a Kindle single. It's only $1.99. So I think Lee is starting to get into the realm of kind of writing a little bit of the short kind of story parts to go along, and it is a reacher, so it has to do something with a short story reacher story, which is something new. Cold Vengeance is out. We have, which is Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. Eric von Lustbader is in the August issue of Suspense magazine. He talks about The Bourne Dominion, which is the next in the Jason Bourne series, which, of course, he took after after Robert Ludlum's death. So there's a lot of great authors that are out. You know, John Grisham's, we're waiting on that one, The Litigators, to come out. That should be interesting. Another one is Stephen King, and we're going to try my butt off to get Stephen King here to talk to us on the radio. Maybe we can get him for this. I hear that he might not be doing anything until 2012, but I'm pushing and pushing to try to get him on. We've interviewed him once for the magazine. I'm desperately trying to get him back on here, but he's extremely busy. But his book is 11/22/63, and if you know the date, that's the date that JFK was killed, assassinated in Dallas. And he kind of has a little bit of take on that, not really who did it, but how someone goes back in time to maybe can alter history, and what would have happened if JFK was never assassinated, and kind of talks about those things. I will say that we got Vince Flynn coming up in the magazine here with his new book is going to be Kill Shot. He's going to be in the magazine coming up in November. So we have a lot of things that we're doing and that we're bringing to you. And, you know, anybody just give us a call or, you know, drop us a line, editor@suspensemagazine.com for a lot of, you know, any kind of information that you want to know about what we're doing, what's going on. You got short stories. You have something, you know, you want to order 4 free issues. Whatever you got. You know, drop us a line. We'd love to hear from everybody. Like I said, we will not be on the air next weekend, but we will be coming back August 27th with author James Rollins is going to be joining us along with some other guests. So James Rollins will be on the show here on August the 27th at 10 a.m. Pacific time. So It's been a great show. I want to thank all of our guests here for coming on. CharlieWilliams.net is Charlie Williams' site. EmilyArsenault.com is her site. And then we just had Andrew Gooley, and managing editor of The Strand Magazine, and Matthew Pearl talking about the book No Rest for the Dead. So until August 27th, I want to thank everybody for joining us. Goodbye. Join us on Facebook. Follow us all over the place. You can find us at SuspenseMagazine.com. Get your 4 free issues. Good day, everybody. Enjoy yourself. See you August 27th.